What the committee did, though, upon pressure from the Southern Wisconsin area chairman, Bob W. of Milwaukee, and the Southern Area Delegate to General Service, Clarence T. of Kenosha, they put on, following Yev, an Al-Anon speaker. They had wanted to have her precede Yev, I don't know why, but the chairman, Dick M. of Madison, goofed, and to correct his error, he put her on second. I don't know why they had her at all, but to listen to her, we're going to have to go over to side two again, and your A-track, I think you call it. I call it side two, track four, and I'm doing this so that we will leave side 2B or side two, track two, open for the Sunday morning program at the ACE Center in Racine. That will be the Lynn Carroll of Hazelden Foundation talk. So from here, turn the tape over to side two, find the end of the horsemen, four horsemen panel, and listen to the conclusion of the Saturday night banquet proceedings.
Why don't you people in the back move up a little bit? I think it'd be better acoustics-wise, not for my voice, but to give those, Lynn a chance to get at all of you. There's plenty of room. Why don't you move up? It's a little easier to hear, I think. I've been asked to welcome you to a degree, but I'm going to let most of the information come from Chaplain Adams, who is connected with the ACE Center. I'm happy to see so many of my friends here, and I will, on the part of Dick T., welcome all of you. And with that, I think I'll give you Chaplain Adams of the ACE Center, who works in the treatment center here, where you're host today. Chaplain Adams.
Ladies and gentlemen, no, I am not being recalled today to the services, but don't bet on tomorrow. This happens to be Armed Forces Sunday, and I held a service here at 9 o'clock and then, pardon me, out on Bong Air Force Base at 10 o'clock and then got back here for a bit of the brunch. Now, in behalf of Dr. Becker, the administrator of this entire shebang, uphill and down, he's the big boss, I'm the little boss, although the little boss is bigger than the big boss, physically. But I'm his assistant with primary responsibility for the A Center, also the chaplain and co-worker with Dick down here. We want to welcome you most enthusiastically, most emphatically. We are more than happy that you have taken time out from your families on a beautiful day like this, when the outdoors is calling. And the blessed Lord says, now look, if you had never taken a drink, you wouldn't have to be inside on a day like this. You know, he needles you a little bit. If he doesn't needle you, he sure is shooting needles me. And, of course, a little of it by the great God is a very good thing. But you are here. We are happy to have you here. We are extremely pleased with the turnout yesterday and today, because Lincoln Lutheran sponsored or co-sponsored along with Pat and his gang and a couple of others to this whole shebang. And having you wind up here, to us, this is indeed a fine thing. I want to give due credit to the staff, staff of Lincoln Lutheran, and to the E-Center 12-step group and their wives. Now, the men, I saw them hauling in some chairs and things last night, but it seems to me I saw your wives here yesterday, and your wives are here again today, and after you get the chairs out, the men get the chairs out, I suppose some of the wives will still be cleaning up something, so maybe we ought to say twice to the wives, thank you for your work and efforts. Then again, we thank you for coming, and those of you who have any distance to go, we pray God's blessings on a safe journey home, God's blessings on your children and or grandchildren who are at home. And to each and every one of you, richest and fullest reception of the message of the afternoon. Now I will turn you over to our good friend Jerry. Or who is, wait a minute, who's that? Oh, Pat, pardon me.
You're going to have to take
pardon me. My apologies, Pat.
All right. Thank you.
I can vouch for the fact that the 12-step members did work, because they were hauling chairs as early as Friday evening, if my memory serves me. Yeah, do you want to say a few words to the people? He said he talked himself out last night. It gives me a distinct pleasure, though, to introduce our speaker for today. My memory and acquaintance and friendship with him goes back quite a few years. I had the pleasure of listening to him and meeting him the first time in Milwaukee. He's a young old-timer, if I can say this. One of the forerunners, the same category that Yev is in the movement of AA, the fellowship that we belong to. He's done a great deal of good. I enjoyed meeting him the first time, and I've enjoyed any encounters that I had with him in the ensuing years. And I'll give you Lynn C., and he's from Minnesota. I'll give him the entire state.
Thank you, Pat, Reverend Adams, men and women, fellow AAs. I, as you know, have been the director of the Hazel Foundation for the last 18 years.
Well, pardon me. And you got to talk into the mic. Mic isn't very, very sharp.
Wait till I get warmed up. In that time, I have seen over 6,000 alcoholics, and I am an alcoholic myself, and I am not in the category of Yem, who was very fortunate in getting this early. I have to be one of the extremists, and I'm not going to bore you with the sordid details of my drinking, because I can sum it up in one sentence. I drank for 20 years. And I finished up with a headache, a heartache, and an empty pocket. And if you're interested in the details, you AAs, you write them, because you know them as well as I do. What I'd like to say this morning is somewhat based on my own experience and what I have gleaned from the many men who came to Hazelden. You know, they say if you steal from one person, it's plagiarism. If you steal from many, it's research. And I have done a lot of research in AA, I can tell you that. One of the things that has impressed me in my work there is the lack of knowledge on the part of many alcoholics who have been in AA for a number of years of what they're trying to achieve in their working within the framework of AA. And physical sobriety won't do it. I think that's one of the fallacies that came to me early. If I could only get sober and stay sober, then everything would be all right. But you see, I wasn't always drunk, and I don't think any alcoholic has been drunk all his life. Why does an intelligent person go back to a toxic drug that is destroying his life if he's in a reasonable state of mind? One of the problems that we've always been confronted with is to convince people emotionally and have them accept emotionally the fact that alcoholism is an illness. Many people do verbally and consciously, but if you do not accept it emotionally, you can be badly hurt by the alcoholic, as many of you wives have been. And we're hard people to understand. Until you know some of the dodges and the vast and complex and almost mythical alibi system, I think you're lost to the alcoholic because he's a lap ahead of you. And the thing that people cannot understand is some of these trivial things that the alcoholic uses as an excuse to further his drinking. Did you ever hear of a man getting drunk because a goose looked at him? I thought I knew them all until I came to Hazelin, and I didn't hear half of them. I thought I invented quite a few excuses myself. Here was a story. This man, and in all seriousness, he told us his story and believed it himself at the time. He'd been given a couple of little goslings, and they grew up. And you know, one thing about the alcoholic, as he progresses in his drinking, and the longer he's drinking, the more complex and involved his alibis become. They're quite simple at first. But later on, you start way back to weave this beautiful piece of cloth that you're going to try and show someone to justify your drinking. And he told about how this goose could do everything but make out his income tax, I guess. He could pick up buttons from the floor, get his slippers, and so on. But his wife got tired of this animal around the house, and she made him sell it. He took it to the butcher, made a deal for it. Well, there were two of them, but this favorite one of his, he looked at it before he left, and Herod was looking at him with such a soulful, reproachful expression that it bothered him. And he drove almost home, but then he got to thinking, what did that goose think about him? And he drove back to buy the goose back, and the butcher had already killed it, and that resulted in a 2 weeks drunk. Now, you can't beat that one. Or another one where man came to AA and he dried up. He's one of these mutts that hang around the bar, you know, perish the thought that he'd ever take a drink. He simply wanted to see his pals, but he became a crossword puzzle addict. He was in the bar one time working a crossword puzzle. His pals weren't down yet. He struck a four-letter word that indicated an intoxicating beverage, and it stumped him for a minute, and finally it came to him, and he said out loud, "Beer." How cruel fate is. You guessed it. A waiter happened to be passing with a tray of schooners of beer, and he set one in front of him. Before he knew what he was doing, he drank it, and then he was off on a long one. Those are almost as good as the guy that says, "I'm going home tonight, and if dinner isn't ready, I'm going to raise hell and fizz ready, I won't eat it." And he can't beat that line of thinking. But you have to realize, and certainly it's obvious to me in working with these men, that a man in a reasonable, analytical, thinking frame of mind is not going to destroy everything that he values in life. He is sick. And sometimes desperately so. And I happen to be one of the extremists. And I know the truth of the assertion that the alcoholic, the extreme of his drinking, is living in a constant state of psychic pain. Boy, when you reach that, I'll tell you, you're sick. And so desperately sick that you don't know which way to turn. Every problem is distorted. Like Francis Thompson said, to the dawn be sudden, to the eve be soon. You hate to see the day come because you have to engage in the ordinary things of life, and they're painful to you. Your association with your family, your wife, anything that you have to do is painful. It's just futility and frustration are your daily companions, and remorse and despair are your nightly bedfellows. And that is not the way of life that the average person wants. There was a friend of mine that I called on early in 1941. A brilliant man, educated far beyond the average person, spoke five languages fluently. And yet, most of the time he spent sailing on dry craters to try and get away from this problem of alcoholism. The man from Minnesota never had enough AA to keep him going, never understood thoroughly what it was because we were all stumbling and fumbling along at first. I made one call on him. Later he got in difficulty and he hanged himself in the St. Paul jail. But earlier, through an incident that happened, he wrote a history of his life and it was published in a book, The Third Strike. And I think in that book, he brings out every phase of this alcoholic picture and answers the questions that perhaps are in the minds of many non-alcoholics and some of the wives that are here. Doesn't he know that he's doing wrong? Of course we did. You can't eliminate the moral culpability from alcoholism. But where that leaves off and where the illness itself begins, I think only the Lord himself knows. But here is what Jerry Gray, his name was Don, but he said, if you sow tares, can you reap wheat? If you sow wrong, can you reap right? If you are impelled periodically to practice knavery, can you ask for purity and virtue? And the answer is obvious, you cannot. And he told how he suffered through the seeming eons of mental misery, false hope, despair, honesty of purpose, dishonesty in action. There's your alcoholic. And in the next paragraph, he brings out the longing, the aspirations, the hopes of every decent and intelligent alcoholic that I have ever known, when and if you can strip away from him the self-deception that's been built up over the years. Somewhere buried deep within me lies the love and the reverence of true womanhood and true manhood, which is not to have something, it's to be something, not to get something, but to give something, not to rule, but to serve. And he told how often that had been brought to his mind only to be torpedoed by the vicious taint to which I am heir. He erroneously thought he had inherited alcoholism from his father. Said, what is it men seek in life? Fame and fortune? Those are the prizes for little men and not for big men, and prizes that inflict much misery in the winning. The rich are richer and the poorer are poorer. And the riches and the poverty are accursed to both. He said, I sought neither fame or fortune. I sought self-mastery, which is the greatest achievement that man can have in life. To do that requires a great deal of effort. And there's a fallacy that I think we've all promulgated.
My word. I think I need new glasses. I'll hold them mine too.
And you hear it so many times in AA that a man returns to normalcy when he quits drinking. And that is erroneous. You don't return to the state that you were in before, or any state that you've ever been in. You either reach a far greater degree of maturity than you ever had in your life, or you're going to affect a greater compromise with stress and go back to drinking and destroy yourself. Those are the two choices. And I think the average alcoholic knows something that the average person does not know. And that is an old image of self must die before a new reorientation can be born. Most people, I think, carry with them all during their life an image of themselves that they have preconceived in their adolescent years and has continued and cursed them all during their adulthood. The true self has no image. It enables you to be yourself, and to the vast credit, I think, most alcoholics who live this program in its entirety try to be themselves without pretense, lying, and deceit, and all the things that are part of alcoholism. I don't think we differ one iota from other people. I see the same immorality, the same hatred, the same resentments in other people that I have seen in alcoholics, but it's more marked with the alcoholic because of his lack of control. Other people do not destroy themselves with some of these resentments and the ill temper that they had, and I was loaded with them when I came to AA. It just goes so far, and then they can stop where the alcoholic goes to excess, and finally the tension builds up, and he's off on the spree. You can't have any kind of an easy, capable way of life without denial, without self-sacrifice, and without self-discipline. I think that's one of the most subversive doctrines in existence today, the idea that you can have the kind of a life that perhaps we all want, alcoholic or not, and get it for free. You earn it in AA. How do you earn it? By restraint, by self-discipline, by denial. And incidentally, all these things that I have heard in AA, I learned when I was a child. I was told that all happiness is based in denial. And if you analyze it, it's true. The unrestricted, unrestrained, licentious person, of course, couldn't be happy, because he'd simply be an animal living without an animal's instinct of self-protection. So in coming to AA, I think it requires the desire to do something about your life. I don't know that any of us came to AA with the idealistic, altruistic attitude, my life is wrong, I want to do something about it. I think most alcoholics came as I did. I knew one thing, I didn't want what I had. But the idea of being able to live a comfortable life without liquor, without my crutch, was something that I couldn't believe at the moment. And of course, it was brought out last night that this period of time that every alcoholic has when he's dry is a barren time for him, because there's nothing to fill that void that happens when liquor is taken away from you, and the time that you spend thinking about liquor, which is a tremendous thing when you analyze it in the period of sobriety. I think you have to come with an attitude of learning. I don't think this place, beautiful as it is, or Hazelin or any other place, or AA is going to do any alcoholic any good until he says to himself, I'm sick, and I want to get well, and then do not question the means by which you have to get well. Accept the treatment in its entirety. And always keep this in mind, any new men that are here, there's always that sense of loss, of giving up drinking, giving up your crutch. It's the old basic theory that Spencer talks about, that the profoundest of all infidelities is that the truth will be bad, and the truth is never bad. It's the avoidance of truth that always caused us trouble. To face this problem, face it honestly and earnestly, be willing to do something about it, then you find that it isn't quite as bad as you thought it was. That's one of the peculiarities, I think, about human nature. That once you muster the courage to face a problem, strangely enough, it doesn't require any courage at all. Always keep this in mind. It's never what you give up. It's what you acquire that's important, and there's never any end to that. I paraphrase something else to apply to AA. I think most of us know the definition, that we're a group of people bound together to solve a common problem. But I paraphrase something else that I think describes alcoholism very well, or AA very well. AA is a science, the study of a lifetime in which you may exhaust yourself, but you'll never exhaust your subject. It is a contest, a duel, a melee, calling for courage, skill, strategy, and self-control, and it affords you the chance to act the gentleman and be the man. But believe me, that takes some doing. In this world of ours, and I use the term frequently, a thing that laid fallow in my mind for 30 years and finally came to me, and AA and served me in good stead, that it's easy enough in this world to live after the world's opinion. Heavenly day, the mass of people are doing it today. Whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, they never stop to figure. It's easy in solitude to live after your own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of a crowd, can keep the convictions gained in solitude. And I think that's the key to AA. That in the seclusion and solitude of your own mind, with analytical and good thinking, to formulate the plan by which you want to live. And that is your business, not mine. And then have that element of greatness that I think I recognize in every alcoholic who lives this program serenely in spite of difficulty. Then you're going to find a way of life that perhaps many of you cannot believe at the present time. I know that when I heard men talk about serenity and peace of mind, I thought it would never come to me. I have it in the major. And I don't know what anyone else has ever got from AA in the line of serenity and peace of mind, but this I know and know well, that what I have today is compared with what I had in the 20 almost to the month years of drinking. Life today to me is paradise, and music and poetry does resound along the street for me. It took time. And sometimes I think we expect too much too soon. You can't take a man who has been in any habit for a period of 20 years as I had been in and expect to change overnight. It's a long, slow process of understanding yourself, understanding some of the needs. And always remember, too, that alcoholism isn't just drinking. Alcohol doesn't cause alcoholism. And that seems like a contrary statement, but if alcohol directly caused alcoholism, practically everyone that drank would be an alcoholic. It's drinking plus many, many other things, plus character defects, plus character faults, and part of the things that are inherent to all of us. Anger, hatred, fear, resentment, self-pity, part of the curse of mankind and part of the commonality of mankind. And those are the things that always drove me back to drinking. It wasn't the desire for a drink, because very few alcoholics have that. It was the desire to escape from some of the problems that I know now were created by a distorted mind. And I know the obsessional thinking of the alcoholic, where he takes even the smallest slight or hurt and balloons it up in his mind until it obscures his entire mental horizon. He can't see anything else. And this deep self-centeredness and selfishness that comes to the alcoholic. I was interested in Yev last night saying that he didn't think he was a selfish person. I never thought I was. Until I remembered being out drinking and what great guys we are in the bar. Oh, boy. The hail fellow well met, and then the heels we are at home sometimes. And you know, I get about half stoned and then think about my family. Why, you'd swim a lake, you know, you'd go into a burning building. But I wouldn't deny myself that first drink for them, which is the greatest gift that I ever gave them. Are you selfish or not? Great deal of selfishness and self-centeredness. Not any different from other people. We all have a reasonable amount of it. And the one thing that I have to watch and will have to watch the rest of my life is the erosion of this world. Because we're living in a materialistic age, in the age of mediocrity. I think any intelligent person realizes that. But mediocrity will never be sufficient for the alcoholic, not with his idealism. And the type of man who I think becomes alcoholic is a man with great drives. I've rarely ever seen the phlegmatic, dull, stupid person becoming an alcoholic. They have the vision, they have the imagination of the alcoholic, who in his grandiosity pictures a world that is idealistic. I think that's how most of us started life. I frequently think of Ehrman's statement, "Let me still remember the bright hours that found me trudging over the silent hills of my childhood or dreaming on the margin of a river when a light glowed within me, and I promised my early God to be faithful in the tempest of the changing years." What happened to me in the 20 years of drinking? Every alcoholic of whatever degree has lost ethical values. Call them ethical, moral, spiritual values. Call them what you want. And I would like to point out very, very strongly that you cannot eliminate spirituality from the educational process. They're trying to do it today, but not very successfully. I love this statement of Soren Kierkegaard, who said that the devil, being quite busy at the moment, has turned the job over to the intellectuals, and they, in their academic way, are doing quite nicely his work. And I think they are. That's why it requires a great deal of independence of thought. What does AA to offer? Actually, it's a beautiful way of life for anyone. Substitute one word in the program, you've got a fine way of life. Where we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable, there's not only the admission of that, because that can be brought about through many, many causes. It can be brought about under pressure to achieve a temporary goal because it suits your fancy at the moment. For instance, the boss tells you, here, if you don't admit that you're an alcoholic, you're going to be fired. What are you going to say? Sure, I'm an alcoholic, without any conviction. Not only has to be the admission, but the acceptance, because acceptance comes from within, where admission can be made from without. The thing that I never recognized, certainly in my picture at any time, is how unmanageable my life was because of anger, fear, hatred, resentment, self-pity, and all those things that are part of human nature and of the curse of the mankind. And I think that some of those things can destroy a man just as surely as alcoholism can. See the spiteful, hateful person. And physical sobriety won't do it, because you can have a perfectly sober body and a drunken, stupid, immoral, spiteful, hateful mind. And I think anyone that has that type of sobriety, I think the second state of the man is worse than the first. It's more than just the acceptance of the fact that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what the word was. They used to call them drunks or inebriates. And you know, I kidded myself so many alcoholics do that no one knew I drank. I found out only two parties ever knew that I drank: the Democrats and the Republicans. It's more than that. They use the term surrender. I use acceptance. The surrender or acceptance of all life. And that applies to everyone. Life as it is, not the way that I would want it to be. But to take the tragedies, the good things, the happy things that happen in life, and also some of the very distressing things in life, and take them in stride, recognizing that they're all part of a journey of life, and that's all life is, the journey from God to God. We hear a great deal about growing up, maturing. Those are all part of the process, but actually it's completing the journey, and unless we understand that, then I don't think life is ever going to make sense to any of us. That many things happen to us on physical journeys, many things happen to us on spiritual journeys, but it isn't what happens to you in life, it's how you accept it and how you look at it. Boy, the thing that I told myself, I can't take it anymore, therefore I've exploded in a spree. Of all the wretched things that I ever told myself in life, and I've told myself many times, wretched things when I was drinking, was I can't take it anymore. I can't take the ordinary stress and strain of life unless I dope myself up. Immaturity in its worst form. You know, one of the illustrations of the immaturity of the alcoholic, and we hate to hear that statement, that I use, if you ever watch kids, I imagine you've all had them or been around them, see them out playing in the backyard there in the sandbox having a beautiful time, God's in his high heaven, it's a beautiful day, until one of them throws sand in the eyes of the other or bangs them on the head with a shovel, which creates an unhappy, unfavorable state of mind in the mind of the child. The mother hears him screaming, which is the only thing he knows what to do. He isn't equipped for the good intake of life. She runs out and gets him and takes him in the house, and as she's carrying him in, he hates these kids, he never wants to see them again. Takes him in the house, gives him a cookie, and a little while he's quieted down, and he's out playing with the kids again. Everything is wonderful. Can't you see the similarity between that and the alcoholic? When he reaches a stage or state where he's unhappy in his mind, it may look to you that it's a wonderful world, he's got everything in the world to live for, but not in his own mind. Well, we're too old to ball, so we dive through the escape hatch of alcoholism to ease the pain of living, and that's why the alcoholic's drinking. He isn't drinking for conviviality. That's passed out of the picture a long time ago. And then in the spiritual part of our program, which has caused some men some trouble, I can understand. We've had the agnostic, the atheist, professed atheist come into Hazelden. I get a kick out of them. I have never yet heard one of them say, I am an atheist, thank God, or thank God I'm an atheist. That doesn't make sense to anybody. They're usually men who, early in their developmental years, have developed some aversion to denominational faith. But you cannot eliminate spirituality's many learning process. Not if you're going to be successful. You know, in a study they made at the Duke University in a formula for peace of mind, they have 9 steps to achieve a degree of happiness and peace of mind, and the 7th step is cultivate the old-fashioned virtues of honor, honesty, love, thrift, which is the use of your time, and church attendance. And that's the first time that I know that science says if you would be a happy person, go to church. I recommend it up there because I think if for no other reason a person should go to church, particularly the alcoholic, for the discipline involved. And we don't like discipline. Boy, they try to put it on me, and we're as stubborn as a mule. You all know that mule story, I guess, about the father bought a mule from his neighbor, and he said, I don't want another balky mule. He said, no, this is a different animal. All you have to do is talk to him or slap him with the reins, and he'll do anything you want. He's almost human. He can understand it. Well, he sold him the book. He bought the mule, and the next morning he hitched him up and came out and he clucked to the mule, and he didn't move. Slapped him with the reins, he didn't move, and he was furious. And he called up his neighbor and said, why are you showing me another balky mule? He said, no. He said, did you do all the things I told you? He said, oh, don't hand me that. He says, you know what you did. He said, no, I'll come over and straighten this out. So he came over and he talked to the mule, and he clucked to him and everything else. He wouldn't move. So I walked over to his own rig and hauled out a baseball bat, and he came over to the mule and slugged him as hard as he could across the forehead. The buyer said, wait a minute, I thought you said you didn't have to lay a hand or a stick on that mule. He said, that's right. But first you got to get his attention. Boy, I had to get clouded before they could get my attention, I'll tell you that. Dr. Jung, in the later years of his life, wrote a very significant statement. He said, among my patients is the second half of life. That would be from the age 35 onward. There has been not one of the thousands of people that he treated for mental illness whose problem as a last resort has not been that of finding religious values, which to me is a very significant statement, and certainly the necessity of acquiring some type of religious values or spiritual values, call them what you want. Without that, how am I going to measure myself by what I see today and what people are doing and the materialistic attitude that a lot of people have? You know, we gauge everything today in the material thing. My neighbor buys a boat, I gotta buy a boat. He has a Cadillac and I have a Ford, he's a better man than I am, but that isn't true. It isn't what you have or who you are, it's what you are. If you're satisfied with that, heavenly days, nothing that anyone says is going to change you. But in this making of the inventory, it's the first time that we ever actually took time to look ourselves over and see the character defects that it brought so much unhappiness to our life. We put out a guide to the 4-step inventory, which I think is pretty complete. And if you look that over, you can tell exactly the type of a person that you have been walking with for many, many years. And it's a shocking thing when you kind of look yourself over and see what you are. You know the great conflict, I think, that comes in the alcoholic mind. And he differs from the hard social drinker or the drunkard. Because they can choose their time and place. They don't suffer from remorse and regret like the alcoholic. The early values that you and I had, call them anything you want, ethical, moral, spiritual values that we were trained with early in life, are part of the deep learning process, and the early learn process you never learn, leave, never leaves you. And then with this erosion that takes place over the years and the drinking where we isolate ourselves from all the things that we enjoyed before and eventually you see what you have become, and I think the conflict in what you see what you are as to what you should have been, there is the thing that brings the remorse and regret in the alcoholic mind. Knowing that you're not living up to your capabilities, and any man that doesn't do that, I think is in a bad way. And then the fifth step, after getting to know something about the character defects and personality defects, we admitted to God, to ourselves and another human being, the exact nature of our wrong, which I think should be done to a clergyman. You know, I heard this stuff, oh yeah, I made the fifth step, I made it to told Bill a little bit, and Harry and Jack a little bit. When I hear that, I say, hogwash. You know, unless you're different than me, the only one I would tell it to is the clergyman, because I don't like to get run out of town on a rail, I'll tell you that. And they are trained in their field, and they can give you advice. And yet it's one of the two weak links in the alcoholic chain. I find that more men come to Hazelin that have been in AA for quite a period of time because of the failure to make the fifth step. Bill brings that out so clearly in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. He tells of the reluctance to do it and how seeking an easier way will tell our friends something that they know about anyhow, that sometimes we're a bad actor. You know, the old drunkalogue. But he said, of the things that really bother and burn us, we say nothing. Certainly distress and humiliation should never be shared with anyone. We hope they will go to the grave with us. And now I am quoting. He said, this is not only unwise, but actually a perilous resolve. And mind you, this is 12 years of experience in AA. That few muddle attitudes have caused us more trouble than holding back on step number 5. Some are unable to stay sober at all. Others will relapse periodically until they really clean house. That AA old-timers sober for years often pay dearly for skipping this step. They'll tell how they try to carry this load alone and how much they suffered of anxiety, irritability, and remorse, and how unconsciously seeking relief, they would accuse even their best friends of the very character defects they themselves were trying to conceal. This release never came from confessing the sins of other people. Each has to confess his own. That's on page 56 and 57 of the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. I suggest you read it, and if you haven't made a fifth step, do it. There's a definite reason for it. One of the oldest psychological factors known about the human mind is once you take a problem out of your mind where you can view it objectively, it no longer has the power to destroy it. Very, very important part of the recovery process. And I hear these are all personal opinions of mine and based on some experience over the years. The man who does not make the fifth step is forever blocked from the rest of the program because he cannot come to step 6 and 7, which go to the core or the roots of our character cancer, until he has made step 5. Evidently, he is not ready to have God remove all his defects of character if pride prevents him from making the fifth step, and that's the only thing that'll prevent you from doing it. There's where honesty come in. I tell the men up there, if they're going to say they stole a rope, don't forget there was a horse on the end. We always make ourselves look good, you know. Fearful that people might think we're not these nice people that we try to appear to others. Step 6 and 7. We're ready to have God remove all these defects of character. What a tremendous step that is, which goes to the root, the core of our trouble, which alcoholism is a personality disorder. Drinking plus poor emotional control plus many, many things is one of the most complex, baffling, and disastrous of all diseases in my book. If you don't believe that, you point out to me one illness today that destroys the total man, mentally, morally, spiritually, and sometimes financially, and destroyed a greater number of men than I think than all the wars in history, as it does has alcoholism. To get at these character defects in 7 is we humbly ask him to remove our shortcoming. Most of us haven't the slightest idea what humility is. We think it's the obsequious bowing before people in high place. That isn't true. Humility knows its strength, but it also admits its weaknesses and mistakes and does not build up any barriers against future success. It's a tremendous quality. And I think the nearest that any of us could come to be humility is this state of mind. Here's a job to do. I don't know how to do it at the moment, but I can learn. And if you're anything like me, you better add, I may have to work longer. I may have to work harder than anyone else has ever worked at this problem, but I can do it because other men who have had the same difficulty that I have had have been able to do it. If they can do it, I can do it. And I think competition is pretty strong in the American's heart. I can give you some many illustrations of this thing to give you a short thumbnail sketch of it. Guard your tongue in a crowd. I've never learned to do that very well. Guard your temper at home and guard your mind when alone. Boy, that takes some doing. The mind can run riot with it. But I think humility comes in a small measure to some of us. I remember one guy we had, and he stood up one night at a group meeting, and he defied any so-and-so in the group to point out that he wasn't the most humble guy in the group. That's a fact. He didn't know what humility was. I'm not a humble person. I never claimed to be. There's too much arrogance in me yet, and there's too much of me in this picture. I would like to have my own way, and my own way has never been advisable. I tried it for 20 years, and it ended in disaster. It's only when I came to the point where step 11 teaches us, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. Thy will be done isn't easy for me today. I would like to do many things that I know are wrong. Well, men sometimes ask me, how am I going to know what God's will for me is? You have a conscience. Ask yourself, is this the right, the just, the honest, and honorable thing to do? Will it help my sobriety? Or is it wrong, dishonest, sneaky, and contemptible, and will it harm my sobriety? Try that one on for size and never take a drink again. I've had a little time behind me. And I can say this, that the greatest harm, the greatest sin that I could commit in this world again is to take another drink knowing what it would do to me. Because to me it isn't a question of just taking one drink. It's certain self-destruction for me. I know me too well. And I've seen too many men go back to drinking after a period of sobriety and lose their lives. Making them amends, I think you make them every day that you maintain this way of life. A little more courtesy, kindness, and consideration at home. And I have seen a lot of men who are marvelous AAs. One thing that was shocking to me, this happened a couple of years ago. We had a double hitter in there, a man and his wife. She came in first, he came in 6 months later. And apparently one of the happiest couple. And this fellow, I wish you could meet him. He's got the most marvelous smile that a human being ever had. Always around the club, always greeting new men, and always this beautiful smile. And after 15 years, the wife had trouble, and she always thought I had a little to do with her sobriety, and her husband called me up and asked me if I'd call on her. She was in the hospital. And I went down to see her, and she opened up then, and she said, Lynn, things are not the way they appear to others. She said, I can't begin to tell you the number of times that I have driven down to that clubhouse with my husband cursing me every inch of the way, and then he walks into the clubhouse with his beautiful smile on his face. What kind of AA is that? It's hypocrisy. I think that if you can live AA at home, in kindness, courtesy, and consideration, and love. And always remember this, the first demand or choice that love always makes upon anyone is the reorientation of your thinking away from self and self-service to others and the service to them. The more outgoing that you are to others, the greater the love. And any information, any knowledge that we have can only be valid if it's illuminated by love, which is the greatest force in life the best thing that you and I will ever know in life. But boy, what misers we are. Somehow or other, we have a reluctance to show people that we love them. I think many men find their spirituality and find their belief in Almighty God through the love of their fellow men. There's an age-old poem that was written by a poet, an unknown poet, centuries ago. I sought my soul I could not see. I sought my God eluded me. I sought my brother, and I found all three. Because I think it's in the love of your fellow men that you find the love of God, which is a very vital thing in the recovery process and then our work with other alcoholics. It's not easy. It's comparatively easy for me to like the people that I'm attracted to and that are close to me, but that is certainly no test of my character to love the guy that doesn't look very good to you, that's mean and ugly, and to try and understand him. I think if you understand people, you will love all people. Liking them is something else again. Now, there are some people I don't want sitting in my lap, but I got to love them, and I want the best for them just like I want the best in life. And then in continue to take inventory. When we're wrong, promptly admitted it. That's still a task for me. I look back in my years of living in AA, and I came to AA when I was 42. I can't find one time that I ever, I may have said it verbally, but that I was convinced that I was wrong. Through some evasion, lying, deceit, blaming others, I tried to justify my own acts or divorce myself from some act that I had committed, and no man can do that because you and I are responsible for our acts. We may stultify the mind by drinking, but still the moral culpability is there. To live this program in its entirety, the 12th step is not only doing work with others, that's vital. You know, there are two trains of thought even in this psychiatric field. One is, and that's the old theory of Freud, that having had your difficulty, your problems, your wrongdoing pointed out to you, then you forgive yourself and go about your business and forget it. But that leads to the absurdity that evil has its own absolution, and that isn't true. And a more reasonable plan that's coming up now, a more reasonable theory, is that having had it pointed out to you what your faults, weaknesses, or evil doing is, that you seek forgiveness